Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live May 18th, 2008, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to join you today. Oprah Winfrey has become a cultural icon for our age by almost all accounts, and most coverage of her is highly favorable, talking about her philanthropy and her good works and how she helps people perfect themselves. Today's guest has written a new book, The Age of Oprah, which will take a contradictory position and argue that instead Oprah Winfrey should be seen in a far more critical light. So join us today for a show of Media Matters. But first, before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The FCC was in the news last week for a couple of ill-considered decisions that raised the hackles of public interest and media reform groups. First, the agency spent millions of public dollars to hire the PR firm Ketchum Communications to educate the public on the upcoming digital TV transition. Ketchum Communications was the same ad agency that secretly funneled $240,000 in payola from the Department of Education to syndicated television and radio host Armstrong Williams to push the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind program. Just last month, the FCC fined two broadcasters for airing Williams' programs without disclosing his government ties, but that didn't stop the FCC from signing a contract with the scandalized firm. And in another head-scratching moment, the FCC ruled that broadcasts of the TMZ Entertainment Show and Pat Robertson's 700 Club qualified as bona fide newscasts. TMZ is an entertainment magazine owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp that dishes the dirt on celebrities. And on his long-running show, Pat Robertson has prayed for vacancies on the Supreme Court, compared liberal Americans to Nazis, and joined Jerry Falwell in blaming feminists, gays, and the ACLU for the terrorist attacks of 9/11. According to FCC regulations, if a TV show is not a bona fide newscast and it airs a story about a political candidate, it must afford equal opportunities to other such candidates for that office. Congress defines bona fide newscasts as those that hold genuine news value and are not intended to boost or aid any particular political candidate. This provision is supposed to shield the public from ideologues and unscrupulous broadcasters by not allowing them to blatantly toe the line for their own corporate and political interests while labeling it news.
When Kenyan-born Edwin Okongo began a graduate degree in journalism at the University of Berkeley, he thought he'd be joining the mainstream media system. But he ended up taking a job as editor-in-chief of a small publication called Mshale, a monthly newspaper for African immigrants that's based in Minneapolis and distributed in print and online. Okongo says the African community in America is very obscure and has needs that differ from African-American communities.
Our culture is a little bit different. So you have people going through trauma after all these years of, you know, living in the war zones and stuff. And we have to do the stories that explain these things and let Americans know that bringing us to America doesn't mean we're home free. We still need help.
Although Mshale's focus is on Africans living in America, Okongo sees the publication as a bridge between cultures and strives for journalistic excellence as well as relevance.
We like to be not only like a resource center for the African community, but also to be as a liaison between that community and other communities, which is why we have to be just as good as anybody. We are teaming up with New America Media, kind of like, you know, a coalition of ethnic media. So it's going to take a while, but, you know, we are learning things, and our goal is really to be that voice for the diaspora.
One of the biggest challenges in bringing stories of the African diaspora to mainstream American journalism is getting beyond the American tendency to stereotype and favor their so-called experts over people who are actually living the story. Nowhere was that more evident than in the often inaccurate reporting of the post-election violence in Kenya earlier this year. Okongo says this type of parachute journalism only happened because journalists hadn't been following Kenya's politics before the story broke.
What they do is that, you know, run in there and go with the age-old excuse and the demeaning that these are just savages hacking each other to death.
Part of the problem is that Americans are woefully uninformed about Africa. Okongo recalls interviewing a professor at Berkeley.
He did not know that there was a university in Nairobi. A lot of people in the journalism department did not know that there was newspapers that are written in English in Kenya. And that really was like, you know, I really need to do something. And that's why, you know, I took this job at Mshale. And it's like, you know, we're going to start, you know, little by little, and hopefully someone will listen.
Edwin Okongo will be speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform in Minneapolis on June 6th through 8th. For more information about the conference, go to freepress.net/conference. And to check out Mshale, go to mshale.com. That's mshale.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Today we've got as our guest Janice Peck, an associate professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder, author of a couple of books, including The Gods of Televangelism, who's written widely in media studies and cultural studies and critical analysis of media. She's joining us today to discuss her brand new book, just published, The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. Janice Peck, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. Thanks very much for inviting me to be on the show.
My pleasure. I've had a pleasure of reading this book. And before we get into it, I think it's probably safe to say that at least some of our listeners are not especially familiar with Oprah or only know of her as a name, not really familiar with her show or the vast extent of her empire. First of all, what is when you say Oprah and talk about the Oprah empire, what does that entail nowadays?
Well, it's actually enormous, and it would be surprising to me if you have viewers or listeners who don't know anything about her. But she is at this point, her net worth is $2.5 billion, and she sits atop a media empire that includes obviously her television talk show, but includes her magazine, her website. She has just launched the Oprah Winfrey Radio Network. She has just finished a reality television program on ABC, The Big Give, which was, kind of a top ratings enterprise. All of these things are interconnected, and so she kind of reproduces the content in one venue for, it's called multipurposing, the content. And the combination of all of these things, as well as her philanthropic enterprise, is what constitutes kind of the world of the empire of Oprah.
And other people have had successful talk shows, Jerry Springer, Phil Donahue, Ricky Lake. They've not been able to translate this into $2.5 billion fortunes. What did Oprah do that was different from these other people?
Well, you know, Bob, that was one of the things that got me very interested in studying her, because I began in the 90s looking at daytime television talk shows during the period when there were a certain number of scandals associated with them. They were proliferating and becoming very sensationalist. And Bill Bennett went after them, and Lieberman, looking at them as kind of trash television. And at that point, Winfrey was a very successful talk show host, but she also began to kind of lose some viewers because of that competition and become, I think, uncomfortable with being associated with a genre that was getting so much criticism. So she consciously decided to kind of remake herself in the mid-90s. And it was the remaking of herself that started to make her very interesting to me in how she went about that. And from about the middle of the 90s, when she decided to emphasize more positive programming, made that very public that that's what she was going to do, and in particular when she launched the Oprah's Book Club in 1996, which got a certain kind of attention because here this person associated with this kind of low-culture form of television talk shows was now promoting literature, a high cultural form. And from that point on, she really separated herself from what she called the trash pack and began to get attention of a certain kind that was very different than these other talk show hosts. And it's also when she began kind of looking at new ways to create synergies with you know, going into business with Hearst, with the magazine, and, you know, launching Oprah Online, Oprah.com, and, you know, getting connected up with Oxygen Network, that it she really took off kind of economically as an empire as well. So the remaking of her persona in the 90s is also part of the process by which she became this powerhouse, kind of juggernaut of a media empire as well.
Janice Beck, who watches the Oprah show, and how many people watch it compared to other shows of that genre?
Well, I mean, first of all, Oprah Winfrey's talk show has, from her first season in 1986, been the top-rated daytime talk show without any really any kind of serious competition. It airs in 134 countries. She gets about 46 million viewers a week, and that's for her show. Her magazine attracts, you know, additional viewers, her website. And it is an audience that is largely female, you know, somewhere in from 70 to 80% female. It is also largely white. And there are some slight variations in that the magazine, for example, is intentionally created to go for a more upscale audience, a younger, say, you know, mid-20s to 49. And professional, kind of middle class. So it's a slightly more upscale audience, and you can certainly see that when you look at the advertising. But, you know, she really is going after kind of a sweet spot of women from, you know, 20 to 55, sort of middle class, working class, and upper middle class.
Why did you decide to write this book, Janice Beck?
Because Oprah Winfrey allowed me, I mean, I'm somebody who studies media, but I also consider myself someone who actually studies society, and I use the media as a way to engage with questions I'm really interested in. And what really interested me about her is that transformation. You know, I wanted to understand, how did a person who simply was a popular television talk show host become what she is today, a cultural icon, and this is terminology that I found, you know, many people using when I was doing this study, because I thought this isn't simply about, you know, one individual person who is talented and has a certain amount of business smarts, which she certainly does, but that the appeal of her, this enormous appeal where she became this, in a sense, a heroine to people. I mean, people just talk about this woman as if she is... I was talking to a woman in a secretary at work recently who was saying that she had gotten tickets to go to the Oprah Winfrey show and that friends and family were so impressed. And she said, you would have thought that I was going to get an audience with the Pope. And this is not something that you would hear anybody say about most television celebrities. So I wanted to understand, what about our culture helped Oprah Winfrey become that figure for so many people?
Is there an Oprah literature in academia? Are there other people who have written books or articles on the Oprah phenomenon that you're contributing to, or are you sort of the first one into the forest?
Well, there's actually an enormous body of material on her, and once you start trying to study her, it's almost overwhelming. Certainly there's a huge amount of just kind of popular material in newspapers and magazines, popular press. There's a fair amount of work that has, you know, kind of academic research that has been done on Oprah Winfrey. Most of it, however, tends to take the same view of Oprah that she presents of herself, which is that she is a largely positive force in the culture, that she is, you know, she describes her enterprise as empowering and enlightening and entertaining people, and particularly, you know, women. And so most of the scholarly work pretty much takes her at her word and says, here's Oprah. She is a black woman. She comes from a poor background. She is an example of someone who has overcome all these odds, has empowered herself, and now she is about empowering other women. And here are the ways in which she does it. So, you know, research that looks at her book club talks about how she's getting, you know, women of all kinds to read books, how she emphasizes literature that had, you know, deals with women's problems and women of color. So it's very, it tends to be very positive. I would say that critical work, which is how I would describe my book, critical work on Oprah Winfrey is much rarer. And it's why I wanted to write this, because I thought that there are some other ways to look at her and look at, you know, her entire effect and relationship with the culture from a more critical perspective.
Now, I assume you had to watch a number of Oprah Winfrey shows to do this research, or at least read transcripts of them. Is that right?
Yeah. I've watched a lot. I have read, when I first really got serious about doing this, I began ordering transcripts and, you know, getting lists of the topics from 1986. So I would say I've read hundreds of transcripts from the beginning of her show. I've watched many, many, many episodes. Have spent lots of time in Oprah.com looking at things and reading message boards and reading the magazine. I immersed myself in that world.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Janice Peck, a professor at the University of Colorado, author of the brand new book, The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. We're going to be talking about this book for the full hour of Media Matters today. Please call if you have any questions or comments. The number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We already have a caller, so let's go to the phone lines right away. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wonder how you think she really bridged the barrier of being African-American with so many whites, that just white women just have no problem at all, who I think otherwise, you know, would have some issues with having a role model, a mentor, whatever, be an African-American. How do you think she really did that?
No, that's a good question, and it's definitely a question that I ask in the book and spend most of a chapter trying to unpack that. There are a lot of different things that she did. I mean, one of the things I think that's most important is that it's very common to see her use the term that she has transcended race, and it's also very common to see that terminology used when people write about her and talk about her. And what I try to discuss in my book is that what the transcendence of race means in this context is that Oprah Winfrey is somebody who has made herself into a figure who is very comforting and comfortable for white women. And she's done that by embracing certain aspects of being an African-American woman in the United States. But those embracing certain kinds of cultural qualities of being black. So she can kind of use, you know, black dialect sometimes, but she doesn't do it all of the time. She can identify with certain kind of black popular cultural figures and certain kind of black heroes. So, you know, Sojourner Truth or Maya Angelou or Martin Luther King. But at the same time, she has, from the beginning of her career, intentionally separated herself from a kind of black politics that might be threatening to whites. So that very early in her career, when she was interviewed in popular magazines, when her show first started in the 80s, she talked about going to an all-black college and feeling very isolated there and feeling very different from the other black students, who she described as angry and radical, and she certainly didn't feel that way herself. So by kind of consistently separating herself from any elements of black politics that might make whites uncomfortable, and at the same time kind of identifying with certain sort of universal values, she has made herself very appealing to a white audience, and she's done it deliberately. I mean, she said, you know, if I just tried to appeal to a black audience, I wouldn't be as successful because, you know, she wouldn't have the size audience she has. So some 80% of her audiences and her fans are white.
Janice Peck, what is your criticism of the Oprah Winfrey Show? You say that most of the scholarship, to the extent it exists, and certainly almost all the popular coverage of her is highly laudatory, praising her philanthropy and her sort of capacity to help people improve themselves. Where do you enter in on this? What's your critique of her and her program?
Well, the thing that interests me the most about this, Bob, and the reason I look at her is not simply because she's this very fascinating object, but because I wanted to understand her and situate her within a particular kind of history. So the subtitle of the book is Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era, and basically, in addition to doing a political history of Oprah Winfrey and her enterprise, I'm looking at her rise not simply as, well, she's very smart and she's figured out how to market herself, but that I'm looking at her as someone who has developed this enormous following because she is a product of our times. And our times, when I use it, you know, those terms, what I'm talking about is over the last 25 years, the rise of a kind of a neoliberal political economic order in which we've seen kind of the decimation of the public infrastructure through deregulation and privatization and cutbacks in social programs, and the idea that government, all problems in our society are the fault of government and the solution is always to be found in the marketplace, that Oprah Winfrey needs to be looked at in that kind of context. So I situate her there, and I connect her with, during the same period, the enormous popularity of self-help, varieties of forms of self-help, kind of therapy, you know, forms of therapy, sort of new forms of spirituality, and the appeal of all of these things for women, and try to understand how you can talk about Winfrey's appeal in the context of this neoliberal project. You know, fix yourself. If you have any problems, you look to yourself, you take personal responsibility, you transform yourself, you do these kind of forms of self-healing, but you do not look to the larger society for solutions to the problems because the solutions are always to be found in the marketplace or inside oneself.
Our guest, Janice Peck, author of the new book, The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters, coming to you live today, May 18th, 2008, here in WILL AM 580. And Janice, again, for some of our listeners who might not be Oprah TV watchers, and maybe even for me, I've only seen Oprah, I have to confess, a handful of times sort of channel surfing and watching segments of it.
You're not the target audience, yeah.
I guess not. And I don't think I've ever seen a program from beginning to end. What is a standard, if there is such a thing, standard episode of Oprah nowadays look like? What would an Oprah show be?
Well, I mean, there's a certain kind of range. Some of the programs, will be bringing on celebrities. Because she has become kind of a cultural icon, she can bring on A-list celebrities on a daytime talk show that no other TV talk show host could do. But there also might be, you know, an episode devoted to a particular issue of the day, and you'll have on the guest experts and then some people suffering from the problems, a certain kind of therapeutic interventions for people's personal problems. Some of it is upbeat, her favorite things, shopping. So if you think of the kinds of subject matter that you see in women's consumer magazines, for example, or in her magazine, her show, in a sense, kind of represents that broad sort of spectrum of stuff aimed at a female audience, issues, lots to do with relationships and family and so on, personalization of issues. So if a show, for example, deals with, I read in the paper this morning that 240,000 jobs were lost in the first 3 months of 2008. So her show might devote itself to job loss, and it would treat it in a personal therapeutic way. So here are things that you could do. You know, they bring people on who have lost jobs, how to deal with your self-esteem, how to network, how to use your friends, and so on. So even when the show deals with political issues, what I would think of as political issues, it will turn them into issues of, you know, kind of psychological well-being and personal relationships.
I remember back in the mid-90s, in an era you write about in the book, when talk shows were coming under considerable attack from political forces like Joe Lieberman and William Bennett, Jerry Springer's show, I think, was at the top of almost everyone's list mm-hmm. as the show to attack. And he said, hey, look, it's just a TV show. We don't have any effect on anything. We're just, you know, harmless entertainment, layoff. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Oprah Winfrey's show has an effect, that it does shape the world, that if she were to do her show dramatically differently, the world would be a different place?
Well, you know, I mean, as one media scholar to another, of course, we're always very reluctant to start making claims, you know, grand claims about the effects of media. But I do think that, I mean, one of the reasons she's worth studying, in my opinion, is because she has an impact on the culture that goes far beyond somebody who just has a television talk show, in part because her enterprise is so wide-ranging. In part because she has certain kinds of, you know, relationships. I mean, for example, she, you know, is backing someone who it's possible may be the next president of the United States. And, you know, through her money and her influence behind Barack Obama, and I think it's very likely if he, you know, if he is elected, if he does become president, that Oprah Winfrey will consider herself to have been one of the instrumental forces behind that. So she does have an enormous kind of power, and if you, you know, if you look at her enterprise closely, it's very easy to see the ways in which she has enormous influence over people who are her fans. So when she goes on tour, for example, you know, her tickets to these things sell out immediately, to these personal growth summits sell out immediately, and people will wait in line for hours and hours. When she decides that people ought to send money to, for example, people, she joined with Habitat for Humanity to send money in to help build houses in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, you know, they respond. Her fans respond. So she certainly does have a kind of political and social power that goes beyond somebody who's just has a TV show.
Our guest, Janice Peck, author of The Age of Oprah, brand new book just released, available at fine booksellers everywhere. The phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Janice Peck, we just had someone call in and couldn't stay on the line, so asked me to transmit their question for them. And they wanted you to go back to the question of neoliberalism, which is in your subtitle, Cultural Icon mm-hmm. of the Neoliberal Era. And they were a little confused by what you mean by neoliberalism. Perhaps you could just elaborate on that and talk about what it's opposed to, what the alternative to neoliberalism is.
Okay, well, kind of to do a little bit of a dry lecturing part here. A way to think about neoliberalism is that it's actually a project to transform the role of the state in the economy, or the government, which is in the U.S., of course, we like to use the term government. So it's in contrast to what preceded it, which is typically referred to as kind of a Keynesian model or the welfare state model, which sees ideally government should participate, have a role in shaping and managing the economy, sort of to balance the relationships between labor and between you know, business and so on. So neoliberalism, which emerges with Ronald Reagan in the 80s, and not just in the U.S., we can look at it with Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom, for example. You basically have a different idea about what should be the relationship between the government and the economy, and it's the idea that, well, the government should stay out of the economy. It's a return to liberalism, kind of in the political sense, which is the market ought to operate entirely by its own internal rules. So it's a view that imagines that the market kind of has a certain kind of way of working.
Janice, let me just interrupt you here for a second, because I think you've done just a great job there explaining it. But I'd like you to link it up now to a theme that's crucial to your book, which is the issue of class and inequality and how neoliberalism relates to that.
Okay. So basically, with the neoliberal shift, what you have is government should get out of the business of messing with the, working with the economy. So we deregulate. We have no government regulation or minimal. We privatize things. We turn it over to business what the state used to take care of. So education, for example. And you cut social programs and you cut money for public infrastructure like schools and so on. What that has meant, basically, is that there has been a dramatic upward redistribution of wealth because neoliberalism also has been accompanied by drastic cuts in the corporate tax rate, drastic cuts in taxes, especially at the top. I don't think for your listeners this is going to be new information. And basically, when you've got a smaller tax base, then what happens is that ordinary people get less back from their government, and the tax cuts have not helped people as much at the bottom. So neoliberalism it also needs to be seen as a dramatic redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top, and that I'm interested in looking at the place of Oprah Winfrey in that larger picture. So, for example, Oprah Winfrey belongs within the top kind of, you know, 0.01% of earners, income owners in the United States, since she's worth $2.5 billion. It's very, you know, it's easy to think of her as this philanthropist because she gives away money and she has her viewers donate money. But at the same time, she has benefited enormously from this redistribution of wealth in terms of the tax rates being changed so that she pays far less money in taxes than she would have in the 70s or the 60s. She's also then selling people the view that they should be responsible for their own lives and that if they're not doing well, then they need to change the way they think about things because that's her own kind of vision. She presents herself as this person who has everything she has today because of the way she thinks. So it's a certain form of kind of selling the system and not asking people to ever look, examine what is the nature of, you know, social relations and political and economic relations. Look to yourself. And that's the, kind of the link I'm trying to make here.
We have a full bank of callers waiting to talk with Janice Peck, author of The Age of Oprah. So let's go right to the phone lines. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Janice Peck.
Hi. I guess I'll focus on this part of it because I've been thinking about so much in this. But what do you do with her being on the horns of the dilemma when the Cattlemen's Association, which is really a front for like Iowa beef and large corporate power, and I don't know. It seems like in that case she was, you know, the antagonist of the very corporate structure that she is. You're saying she, in a way, supports and symbolizes. And I'm wondering whether that, how that worked out for her in the sense of, I don't watch it, but I mean, her, the kind of programming, did it actually, I mean, I suppose one would say, one would reduce it to, you know, she won against people that want you to eat more beef, as opposed to the idea that there was actually a, you know, a real corporate battle at stake in some bizarre proxy way.
Well, I
Janice, before you answer that, if you do us a favor and give a little background for people who might not be familiar with the Oprah Winfrey run-in with the cattle industry.
Oh, okay. All right. So the cattle industry got upset with her because she, you know, it was around the question of tainted beef, and so someone came on her show, and she said that she would be afraid to eat beef. You know,
this was a little over a decade ago, if I'm not
mistaken. This was, you're right. Time moves fast. Yes, it was around 98. And so, you know, so she said, I would be concerned and worried about eating beef. And then the Cattlemen's Association, of course, wanted to sue her because they were, you know, considered, because they knew how powerful she was. And they were worried about its, the impact on sales. And so it went to court and she prevailed, you know, kind of in terms of freedom of speech issues. And so, I mean, it's a good point. And I don't want to suggest, because I'm not taking the stand that, I guess I don't want to simplify it and say that, well, Oprah Winfrey is rich and powerful, and therefore, in every instance, in all moments, she will align herself with anyone else who is rich and powerful, and we can just predict what her stand will be in any given instance. Because, you know, that's too simple, and certainly in this is an example where that's, you know, not the case. So I'm not making that kind of a claim about her. At the same time, I do think it is valuable to look at the world through the lens in which we start to ask, how do we think about class and class relations? And, you know, and Winfrey is situated within that system, all right, where 80% of the people in the United States basically share about 9% of the wealth, and the other 20% have the rest of it, of the net financial wealth. I think it's important to ask questions about what is the world view and what are the interests of someone like Oprah Winfrey. And when she has an enormous following, should we consider ways in which her interests and the interests of those of her followers actually are at odds with each other?
Our guest, Janice Peck. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Janice Peck.
Yeah, I suppose we'd be hard-pressed to find any billionaires that have a radical analysis of the political economy and be willing
yeah.
to use their position to, you know, in any way, you know, fundamentally challenge that and become a traitor to their class. But I'm curious if you could go a little deeper into, you know, her insertion into electoral politics. I know that there was a fair amount of coverage of her early endorsement of Obama, but I haven't seen much, you know, evidence of her campaigning for him now. Maybe I just haven't noticed it. Or they're just not covering it in the, you know, mainstream media. But I'd, you know, if you could get a little deeper mm-hmm. analysis of, you know, her and her willingness to get involved in campaign politics.
Yeah, you've made a good observation, and in fact, the reason that you haven't seen a lot of coverage lately is because she has pulled back from it. And it's not that I've called her up and said, by the way, you know, what's going on here, but I've been following this, and I'm not surprised because she has historically kept a certain distance from what we think of as kind of the explicit electoral politics, even though since about the mid-90s, there have been various kind of quarters calling for her to run for public office. I mean, Michael Moore even suggested that she, at one point that she run for president or vice president. And a lot of people have suggested that. And, you know, there's even kind of comic, I don't know how comical they are, you know, buttons that say Oprah Obama. But her decision actually to explicitly endorse a candidate is unusual, because she has always presented herself as someone, I mean, she has said, well, I think I could run for office and I think I would be elected, but I have more influence doing what I do.
And if I can just interject, Janice, for a second, because in your book you have a long discussion of how close Oprah has been to the Clintons throughout the 1990s. And I'm just guessing, but I would imagine a significant amount of her viewer base would be sympathetic to Hillary Clinton.
Well, this is the thing, too, Bob, I mean, with why she has pulled back. Because she decided that she was going to endorse Obama, and she had had him on her show even when before he was running and, you know, and had encouraged him to run, it was a bit of a surprise because, historically, it would seem very... I would have expected her to endorse Hillary, you know, to support Hillary Clinton. And the fact that she decided to endorse Obama was a risk for her politically. And what happened after she did it, and I don't think that she expected it, because I think Oprah Winfrey has kind of bought her own line about having transcended race, so that her viewers love her and race has nothing to do with their relationship, and that therefore she could endorse Obama, and, you know, even though he's black, and that would have no kind of racial implications whatsoever for her followers. In fact, that was not true. Once she endorsed him, because I've been going on to Oprah.com and reading message boards for years about various subjects, I know that it is very unusual to see any criticism of Oprah Winfrey on her own website, because it's mostly a fan site. What happened after she endorsed Obama is that for the first time, you began to see extensive criticism of her. And it was because her fans were, you know, have not transcended race, because we don't live in a society that has transcended race. And so there were a significant number of people posting messages accusing her of being a racist, because they were saying she endorsed Barack Obama because she's black and he's black, and that somehow made her a racist and kind of a traitor to them, to her followers. There were also people very upset with her because they were Hillary supporters, and why was she not supporting Hillary? There were also Republicans, because her fan base is not all Democrats by any means. Republicans who were upset with her for endorsing a Democrat of any kind. So it was kind of a risk, and my guess is that she actually ended up being surprised by the depth and the extent of the criticism. And you can go on her site now, and people are still posting things, very angry things. And some of it is actually fairly ugly, which is also not that common on her website. So my feeling is that what she did, because she is a smart businesswoman, is she pulled back and has stayed, you know, more of a hands-off position with the thing now, waiting to see what will happen.
Well, you do make a good point, Janice Peck, in the book about the close relationship that Oprah and her sort of worldview had with both Clintons in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And so it was striking to me then, as I'm reading that, to understand that she would come out later for Obama.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there is a certain kind of affinity. I mean, remember, he's from Chicago. Chicago's her hometown. I do think that there is a certain kind of pride and relationship there because he is black. I mean, it's the same sort of thing that you're seeing in coverage of, you know, who's supporting Obama now among Democrats, and lots of black Democrats are saying that the fact that he is black is important to them. So I don't think that this is irrelevant, but in terms of the kind of political positions of Obama and Hillary Clinton, most, and this is true, I mean, when people analyze these two candidates, the differences, political differences between those two candidates are very small. If anything, Obama, in certain issues, is to the right of Hillary Clinton. But for the most part, politically they're very similar. So, you know, Winfrey, when she was saying that she's a fan of Obama, she said, "I have nothing bad to say about Hillary Clinton at all," and she easily could be a supporter of Clinton, I think, politically as well.
Our guest, Janice Peck, author of The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era, a brand new book. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Peck, the phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Janice Peck.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I guess the author addressed some of my questions already in her previous in her last response, but let me follow that up a little bit further. If Oprah's basic message is one of responsibility, of self-responsibility, is that inconsistent to some extent with the platforms of both Clinton and Obama, and would you expect her to be, say, a supporter of McCain instead? And that's going too far, but is there some shade of distinction between Clinton and Obama that's important here, where she might philosophically be more inclined to support Obama than Clinton? I'll hang up and listen offline. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a good question. And, you know, and you're asking me to, and I'm not sure I know the answer. The thing about Oprah Winfrey is that there's a popular perception of her that she is, you know, this kind of very liberal figure. And one of the things that I'm trying to point out in the work that I've done on her is that I would say that it's better to characterize her as, well, I mean, in some ways, the reason why I said that she's close to the Clintons is because I argue in the book that Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council, which, you know, kind of, you know, catapulted him to national recognition, was a project to move the Democratic Party itself to the right, and that Oprah Winfrey's own politics, to the extent that she identifies herself as a Democrat, is as a centrist Democrat. I mean, by no means would she be someone whose politics could be seen to be on the kind of the left end of the spectrum of the Democratic Party, say, you know, Paul Wellstone, somebody like that. And that both Obama and Clinton are centrist Democrats, and that, you know, she, Clinton is certainly, you know, an important figure in the Democratic Leadership Council, and Obama was, you know, I mean, they tried to induct him into the council, and he's tried to separate himself from it, but his economic advisor is the economic advisor to the Democratic Leadership Council. So I would say, in some ways, the differences between Clinton and Obama are very slight. And on their health care plan, for example, his is to the right of her.
But, you know, Janice, let me just interrupt to get back to the conversation for 1 second before we move on, which is, you know, if she's gung-ho for all this self-help and self-improvement and pull yourself up by the bootstraps and don't look at the system, look in the mirror, isn't that the sort of rhetoric we routinely hear most emphatically from the Republican candidates?
It is. It certainly is. But it has also been, what I'm interested in the kind of the bigger picture, is that that sort of ideology, to use that term, has now become kind of a commonplace, so that you also hear it from Democrats. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly this is the kind of rhetoric that we heard from Bill Clinton around the idea that we need to get rid of welfare as we know it, that we need to, you know, make people be responsible and so on. So that kind of rhetoric that you take personal responsibility, you look in the mirror, you don't look to government, right, for answers, has become, in a sense, kind of so commonplace that, let me give you an example. You know, over the past weekend, I was invited to do a symposium, and it was undergraduate students at Northwestern University who put it on. And they were, you know, young people who see themselves as, you know, very interested in social change and social issues. And so they were, you know, I did a presentation on philanthropy, celebrity philanthropy, and I was talking about Winfrey. And a couple of the students were saying, well, but, because I was saying, well, you know, this is a rethinking of the role of government. And they said, well, government is the problem. And, you know, government's bad. And I thought, this has become so commonplace now. It's like common sense that government is the problem. And that it would, you know, this is not the place that you look when there is a social issue or that needs to be addressed. You don't think of the government. And I said to them, well, who, you know, who do you think the government is? What do you think government is? Because when I was their age, one of the ways to answer that question was the government is us. But that's not what people think now. They think of government as this outside entity. And I think that becoming common sense, that government's a problem, the solution has to be personal or it has to be found in the marketplace, that's been brought about not just by the Republicans. That has also come about through the movement of the Democratic Party to the right, and that Clinton, both of the Clintons and Obama, are part of that legacy.
And in the book, Janice Peck, you do really elaborate on that theme quite a bit and talk about the whole self-help movement and what I used to call, or what used to be called, psychobabble. The sort of probably taking the same theme but putting it in a sort of a new age lingo. We have more callers waiting patiently to talk with Janice Peck, author of The Age of Oprah. Let's try to get to both of them before the program ends today. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Janice Peck.
Oh, okay.
Line 2, it's you're on.
Okay. I had a number of comments about liberalism, but I'll skip those since we're low on time. Do you deal anywhere in the book with her part in the Satanism scare that popped up in the 80s in which she seemed to be.
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay. And I'll hang up, let the next caller go.
Well, thank you very much. You know, before we go to the next caller, the one other person emailed and asked me to ask you about the South Africa school that Oprah founded that had the scandalous fall. And you refer to this in the book and talk about it. And what was striking to me as I read it then, and what was striking to me when I first heard about the school, was her reason for doing it in South Africa rather than in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I talk about in the book because it seems so striking to me. And that is, and she began to get involved in doing things in South Africa actually in 2002, where she did something called Christmas Kindness, and she gave Christmas gifts to youngsters in South Africa, many of whom were orphaned. And it also, not coincidentally, was the year that she launched the first international edition of the Oprah magazine in South Africa. The school, for those of you who don't know about this, is it's called the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls. It was opened in January 2007, and it's a boarding school on 52 acres. She spent $40 million on this school, and a very, very lavish school with a yoga studio and all of this kind of stuff. It's for poor girls. The acceptance rate to get into that school is 4% compared to 9% acceptance rate to get into Harvard. She personally selected the first class. She interviewed the girls and picked them personally. When she was asked about why she decided to spend this kind of money on a school, a very, you know, elite school for girls in South Africa, rather than putting money into schools and education in the U.S., I think it was a Newsweek, if I'm remembering correctly. She said that she just got tired of going to inner-city schools in the U.S. because the kids are only interested in iPods and sneakers. They're not interested in learning. And that the children in South Africa don't ask for these kinds of things. They ask for uniforms to go to school. And this is, I think, important kind of to think about because what it does is imply to her fans that her statement about children in school districts in cities in the U.S. who are poor, and inner city, of course, is always a code word for black children, that somehow these kids aren't worth spending any money on because, you know, they're not interested in learning. And I think that that's a very damning statement. And for someone of her stature and authority to make that comment gives it a certain legitimacy and truth that, you know, I think has no relationship to reality. But, you know, Africa is a place where, you know, you don't have to deal with kind of the issues of, you know, U.S. politics. So it's kind of easy to, you know, say, well, we're going to give money to Africa.
Our guest, Janice Peck, author of the new book, The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. Let's go to our final caller of today. Line one, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Is that me?
That's you.
Okay. My kind of statement for the author is that I just find it a little interesting, shall we say, that the author would construct her neoliberalism theory and then try to make Oprah fit into it in terms of holding her to some kind of standard that the author herself has developed. And, I mean, we all know everybody, most individuals are not liberal or conservative or that kind of thing, and maybe in the political sense, but in the way that one lives their life and their beliefs and things like that. So, you know, people can be all over the map in those kinds of things, and I just think it's a little disingenuous for the author and her whole theory of neoliberalism. I'm kind of suspect. I'd like for her to maybe talk a little bit more about that, but then to develop that theory and then make somebody else adhere to that theory. I find that, like I said, a little disingenuous. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Colin. Janice, we've only got a few minutes left, so I think you might not want to spend too much time going back over neoliberalism.
Oh, okay. I just want to let the caller know that I didn't. This isn't a theory that I personally developed. Actually, it's something that's been written about extensively And it's not, and I'm not saying it's a theory that Oprah Winfrey, you know, personally says I'm a neoliberal. It's a theory that talks about the way that the political economic situation is constructed, and so I'm situating her practice inside that, as opposed to saying this is her own philosophy.
All right. Do you want to add anything more, though, Janice, about the concern that you're sort of just sort of force feeding your interpretation onto Oprah unfairly?
Well, you know, I know that, and I'm certainly aware that I'm writing about a figure that has an enormous following, and about a figure who has given a great deal of money to lots of important things in the world. And so it's not that I'm saying that it's bad that Oprah Winfrey supports building homes for people who've lost homes, you know, because of Hurricane Katrina, or that it's bad for her to build schools in South Africa or to give money to causes. You know, I certainly am not saying that. What I'm trying to do here in writing in a more critical way about Oprah Winfrey, it's not about her personally. It's more that what I'm trying to argue is that it's important to take a step back from what on the surface looks to be, you know, totally unproblematic, which is that you do, you know, good works, and ask why, what kind of world do we live in such that it's now necessary to turn to philanthropy and charity to deal with things like, you know, funding education and, you know, giving people money for health care, because those kinds of things now have disappeared from, you know, being funded publicly. That's what I'm interested in. So it's not really just a personal attack on this one figure.
Are there other talk shows? I assume you've done some analysis of the field of the genre to get a sense of where Oprah fits in. Are there others that do a better job of contextualizing personal issues in a social context? I mean, to give people a sense of agency as political and social figures, not just as individual people in their own lifestyle?
You know, I think it's, I don't think that I can come up with examples that do that. I mean, and it's partly because, you know, you're dealing with television and you're dealing with an entertainment medium. And so, you know, in part to say, well, you know, what she should be doing is doing this kind of deep political analysis is perhaps not fair, you know, in that, you know, no other show does it either. It's more that I'm looking at this kind of larger phenomenon, and rather than saying if her show did this, then it would be good. It's what I'm doing is using her. I guess I'm using her to ask bigger questions about what's going on in the world, as opposed to saying, well, if she changed her show and did this, then it would satisfy me.
And how's the response to the book been so far, Janice Beck?
Well, I mean, it's brand new, and so I'm still, you know, I mean, I'm waiting to see what the response is going to be. So I'm hoping people will buy it, and then I'll find out what they think about it.
Have you ever had a chance to speak directly with Oprah Winfrey or any of her people when you
were? No, when I was in the 90s, when I first began doing work on her, I tried to get interviews, and I was told, and then she was not the kind of mega character she is now. I was told that she doesn't do interviews with academics. And so, you know, no, I haven't. So perhaps, I don't know if I'll hear from them now.
Our guest today has been Janice Peck, the author of the brand new book, The Age of Oprah, Cultural Icon for the Neoliberal Era. Janice, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
Okay.
That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And listeners, we'll be back next week with Arianna Huffington as our guest. I want to thank Andrew O'Boyle, my producer, Matt Kessler, for working the board. And have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.